Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to try and make sense of one of the most baffling and honestly tragic case studies in modern history.
It really is.
We're diving deep into the story of June and Jennifer Gibbons, who became known all over the world as the Silent Twins.
And this is a deep dive that really forces you to confront the absolute outer limits of human connection. Of, you know, psychological dependency.
Right.
We're talking about two identical individuals who, from everything we can tell from the sources, basically manufactured a single shared consciousness.
A shared world that only existed between the two of them.
Exactly. And it's a relationship that was so symbiotic, but at the same time so violently antagonistic,
yeah,
that the only way out, it seems, was fatal. It's still probably the most disturbing documented case of extreme twin interdependence we have.
That's the core of it, isn't it? That
yeah.
Tension. And that's what we need you, the listener, to grapple with us on. We want to understand the terrifying boundaries of what's called twin interdependence.
Which goes so far beyond just being sisters or, you know, sharing DNA.
Oh, absolutely. We're going to trace their life together from the 1970s in Wales, and we'll look at how this refusal to speak to the outside world led them down a path of synchronized self-destruction.
Culminating in a sacrifice that is just unbelievable.
It really is. The initial snapshot of the case sounds simple, but it's so unsettling. You have two sisters who, almost from when they were toddlers, just refused to speak.
To anyone. Not their parents, not their teachers. They only communicated with each other in this unique, rapid-fire, coded language.
They didn't just choose silence. It feels like they actively built a fortress around themselves.
They did. And while you might hear about twins having a private language and think, oh, that's a cute quirk.
Yeah.
This was not a quirk. The records show this shared life wasn't a phase. It was a fundamental, almost desperate fight for control.
And we're going to watch that dynamic escalate from just silence to bizarre physical control to synchronized crime, institutionalization, and then finally, this calculated terminal sacrifice.
A sacrifice that bought one sister's freedom at the cost of the other's life. And that's the central mystery, isn't it?
It is.
How did this shared psychological existence become so mutually exclusive that one of them had to die for the other to function, to be mentally healthy? We have to look at this not just as a weird story, but as a clinical record of a closed system that basically cannibalized itself.
A truly chilling way to put it. Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start at the beginning.
Right.
The genesis of their shared silence, the formation of their world. Let's get into Act One. #tag the silent childhood and undecipherable connection. So we start in the 1970s. June and Jennifer Gibbons, they're identical twins, born in 1963.
And their parents, Gloria and Aubrey Gibbons, had moved from Barbados to the UK. Now that detail seems small, but it's actually crucial.
Why is that?
Because the family was already navigating this intense isolation. They were one of the only, if not the only, black families in a predominantly white part of Wales.
Ah, okay. So there's already an external pressure and environmental isolation happening.
Exactly. And that may have just compounded the twins' own inherent tendency to withdraw. The sources suggest that almost right away, maybe around age 4, something just felt wrong.
Profoundly wrong. Their older siblings were engaging with the world, but June and Jennifer became completely nonverbal.
To anyone outside their own tiny orbit, it wasn't just, you know, being shy.
No, this was an active, comprehensive refusal. They wouldn't answer teachers in school. They wouldn't talk to their parents at home. They were totally ostracized by the other kids.
It was an inherent state of being for them, but one they actively maintained. And psychologically, that complete refusal to engage with language, that's the first really critical step they took in building their exclusive reality.
It's like they were shadow playing with the world. They were physically present, but they refused to validate the outside world by speaking its language.
And can you just imagine the terror of being a parent or a teacher trying to break through that silence?
It must have been maddening.
Yeah.
Because they weren't just quiet. They were actively resisting any attempt to connect.
Right. They were eventually sent to speech therapists, doctors, you name it, but all of these attempts just failed completely.
Because The moment they closed the door on the outside world, they had already built something much more powerful to sustain their internal one.
And that powerful mechanism was, of course, their secret language.
Okay, we need to spend some time here. Because we hear about twin languages, right? It has a name.
Cryptophagia, yes. And typically, it's a mix of unique words, maybe some baby talk spoken really fast between siblings. But, and this is the key, it almost always fades away as kids learn the dominant public language.
Because that's more useful for getting what you want in the world.
Exactly. But the Gibbons twins' language was different.
It stuck around.
It persisted right into their adulthood, and it was so specific, so impenetrable, that no outsider could decipher it. They spoke incredibly quickly, often in this weird parallel rhythm.
Like they were finishing each other's sentences,
yeah.
But in a language no one else understood.
Yes. It was documented they might only use one or two words of English in an entire day, and even then, only to each other.
That implies a whole different cognitive structure.
Yeah.
They weren't just sharing a few slang words. They had built a complete framework for reality that only they lived in.
It's the ultimate us versus them.
Wow.
And that shared system creates what you could call a shared epistemological bubble. Every single piece of knowledge, every observation, every interpretation of the world around them was filtered through this coded, unique system.
So if you can't decode the language,
you can't access the reality. This deliberate, impenetrable boundary made their knowledge their power. And their power was their isolation.
That's a fascinating way to put it. So the silence wasn't a weakness, it was a choice. And the language was the tool they used to enforce that choice.
Precisely.
But what happens when that exclusive world starts to feel too small? Or when the dynamics inside that world start to shift?
That's exactly the trajectory we see as they hit adolescence, the isolation and the language.
Right.
They evolved into something much, much stranger.
A state of intense interdependence that started to manifest physically and violently.
Yes. The earliest signs were described by people who saw them as this eerie synchronicity. At first, you might think it's harmless. You know, they'd walk in perfect lockstep or move their arms in the exact same way.
We see that with twins sometimes, sure.
Yeah.
But the sources we have show that with June and Jennifer, it was way more than just mirroring.
Oh, it was a psychological struggle for dominance. This wasn't harmony. This was a psychological tug of war. And the prize was control over the very definition of their shared existence.
So they were so interdependent that they were basically competing for the same psychological space.
Rather than occupying two distinct ones, they had merged, and now this merged entity was fighting with itself. That's a condition doctors later called symbiotic psychosis.
And if they're fighting for the same psychological space, the stakes for every single interaction, even nonverbal ones,
they become incredibly high. It was a constant negotiation of identity.
And we know this because they both kept diaries.
Yes, extensive diaries. And these writings are the absolute cornerstones of this case. They give us this chilling, contradictory window into their private thoughts.
So what do the diaries actually say about this interdependence?
They revealed both this profound, deep love and an absolute, almost murderous hatred.
Both at the same time.
At the same time. Jennifer wrote something like, "We have decided to starve ourselves to death so we can be together, but one of us will have to die first."
Chilling.
And June wrote equally dark things. She described her sister as a shadow and wished her dead so that she, June, could finally be free.
So this interdependence wasn't sweet. It wasn't affectionate.
It was mutually destructive. They knew even then that their shared existence was fundamentally incompatible with individual freedom.
So the language and the silence created the shared mind. And the writing chronicled the war being waged inside that mind. And this shared internal life, it started to demand physical obedience.
Yes. The system they created, this Gibbons entity, it couldn't tolerate any deviation. And the effort required to maintain it led to these extreme visible behaviors.
Which is the perfect transition to the next stage. This is where the psychological fight becomes physically and behaviorally destructive.
Exactly.
So let's get into that escalation. How the fight for control over this single life started to manifest in these bizarre physical ways and eventually criminal ways. #tag escalation, fighting for control of a single life. Okay, so we've established this intense, mutually destructive psychological bond. It's fueled by their secret language and these secret competitive diaries.
Right.
And here's where the story takes a turn into something that feels medically inexplicable. We're talking about the physical manifestation of this extreme interdependence.
This is the data that truly alarmed and frankly stumped the medical community when they started documenting the girl's behavior in more clinical settings.
The sources describe these specific, bizarre, synchronized behaviors, behaviors that actively defied basic biological urges.
Yes. You mentioned biological control. Let's detail that because the descriptions are genuinely disturbing. This wasn't just walking together.
No.
This was controlling involuntary actions.
Like what?
It was documented that when one twin took a breath, the other would hold her breath. She would wait for the other to inhale before she allowed herself to do the same.
Wow.
And even more shocking was the observation about their eye movements. When one twin blinked, the other would literally force herself not to blink.
Staring for painfully long periods just to maintain this synchronicity.
Yes. I mean, think about the willpower, the sheer constant psychological enforcement it takes to override basic reflexive biological functions, your autonomic nervous system.
Things like breathing or blinking, just to stay in sync with one other person.
It's a profound level of control, but you have to ask, was this shared obedience or was it shared aggression?
What do you mean?
Was one twin forcing the other to hold her breath as an act of dominance? Or were they both, maybe unconsciously, competing to see who could withstand the physiological urge longer?
Proving who had the superior commitment to this shared entity they'd created.
Exactly. And when you look at the doctor's interpretations, they found this evidence just chilling. The clinical consensus was terrifying. They called this the most extreme case of twin interdependence ever recorded.
The synthesis was that it was, and this is a quote, like they were fighting for control over a single life.
And that distinction is vital. They weren't fighting for their own individual right to exist. They were fighting over who had the power within the combined symbiotic unit they had created.
Their shared identity was struggling violently against the natural biological impulse to just be an individual.
So if things like breathing and blinking become tools of political action within their private world, every single second of their existence was a performance, a battle waged to maintain that shared reality.
And the physical mirroring was the proof of that battle.
The consequence of failing to mirror was the risk of suffocation. And their diary suggests they feared that more than pain, more than even death itself. To them, being an individual seemed to equate to dissolution. So to maintain the bond, they had to suppress their own individual biological rhythms.
It's the ultimate paradox. They had to suppress their own life functions to maintain their shared life identity.
And as they got into their late teens, this profound internal struggle, this frustration, it inevitably spilled outward. It had to. It manifested as external chaos.
The focus shifted from psychological control to synchronization of deviance.
Yes, that's a good way to put it. The destructive interdependence found a way to externalize its rage. After they left school and tried very briefly to engage with job training, their behavior escalated dramatically.
The sources list a series of synchronized crimes: arson, theft, vandalism.
Right. And it's important to understand this wasn't just typical teenage delinquency.
No, this was a pattern of highly destructive behavior. What were the specific things they did?
We're talking about serious offenses. They engaged in reckless theft, but most worryingly, multiple acts of arson. They once tried to burn down a school building. Another time they stole some clothes, tried to pay with a forged check, and then set the clothes shop on fire.
And the synchronization was the key.
Always. They were always together, always synchronized. The crime itself was just an extension of their destructive interdependence. It was a way for them to express their unified rage against a world that rejected their unique way of life.
So the crime wasn't about money or getting things.
No.
It was about affirming their unity through external destruction. They're using external chaos to maintain their internal order. They were basically saying, you can't separate us, so we're going to show you what we can do together.
And the arson in particular, it feels like an expression of their shared alienation and frustration. The fire was maybe the ultimate visual metaphor for their internal life. Volatile, destructive, all-consuming.
And of course, the courts, seeing this extreme psychological pathology, eventually had to intervene.
This destructive path led to the inevitable outcome, institutionalization. They were deemed dangerous to the public and critically to themselves.
And they were eventually committed to Broadmoor Hospital.
A high-security psychiatric facility.
Yes.
Yes. And that commitment was a defining moment. It was supposed to treat them, separate them, reintegrate them into society.
But the paradox just continued.
It did. While the high-security environment contained their physical bodies, it did almost nothing to break the psychological bond. In some ways, the confinement just intensified it. It confirmed their us versus them reality.
So they took their self-contained, warring universe and just put it inside the highly structured walls of an institution. Were they separated there?
They were separated at times, but even physical separation proved useless. When they were in separate rooms, they'd communicate through these long, feverish, handwritten letters to each other.
So they just found another way.
And these letters mirrored the diaries. They would swing between expressions of this profound longing and just visceral hatred. June might write something like, "I am trying to break away from her, but I can't. She has cast a shadow on my life."
It sounds like their time in the institution wasn't really a treatment. It was more like the final high-pressure environment where their internal conflict reached critical mass.
Exactly. The walls might have been holding their bodies, but the psychological structure they'd built was crumbling under its own unsustainable weight. This confinement became less a treatment facility and more the final stage of their complex dualistic existence.
And it was in that high-security setting where the ultimate irreversible decision was made.
The pact. It was formulated and declared right there. The system required a radical intervention, and they chose the most absolute form of severing possible.
Which brings us to the final and most baffling part of this story. The ultimate sacrifice. #, #, the pact, the sacrifice, and the unexplained death. So while they're institutionalized in Broadmoor, June and Jennifer are fully aware that this place is designed to keep them separate, or at least to suppress their interdependence.
Right. And it was in that setting that Jennifer delivered what would become the most chilling and consequential declaration of their shared life.
She looked at June.
She said, "One of us has to die so the other can live."
That phrase it's not just dramatic. It's a cold, clinical statement of necessity. It synthesized 2 decades of their psychological struggle into one sentence.
It established the absolute necessary condition for one twin's freedom. It was an explicit recognition that their existences were fundamentally mutually exclusive. The single life they had been fighting over could no longer be split across 2 bodies.
It was the logical, if tragic, conclusion to their shared pathology. For years, doctors had observed them fighting for control over a single life.
And now, the entity itself had decided which half was salvageable and which half had to be eliminated.
And outsiders, I mean, they might just dismiss this as some kind of psychiatric fantasy, right?
Of course. But the twins clearly understood the gravity and the literal terms of this agreement.
And crucially, the sources seem to imply that Jennifer was the one who decided she would be the sacrifice.
She determined that June had the higher potential for individual freedom if only the bond could be severed. That's the interpretation June herself offered later.
Okay.
Jennifer had been struggling with deep depression and had maybe internalized this belief that she was the dominant destructive force holding June back. In their final months in Broadmoor, they grew intensely reflective. They knew a change was coming.
They had made their rules, and now it was time to execute them.
Right. So we move forward to 1993. The twins, after years in this high-security hospital, are finally being released, not to total freedom, but to be transferred to a less restrictive clinic.
And this transition, this physical removal from the confines of Broadmoor, this was the trigger.
This was the moment the pact had to be fulfilled. They were being moved by transport to the new clinic.
The journey had barely even begun. And then the immediate dramatic event happened right there in the transport car.
Jennifer leaned her head against June's shoulder, whispered something, and then immediately died.
Instantly. This wasn't a slow decline.
No, it was an instantaneous collapse.
And the medical response, I mean, that must have caused absolute chaos. What did the postmortem find?
Chaos is an understatement. The death was sudden, completely unexpected, and totally unexplained. The postmortem examinations were inconclusive.
So no evidence of a drug overdose poisoning?
Nothing. No major organ failure, no known disease. It was officially deemed a sudden, unexplained death.
How does a seemingly healthy young woman just lean her head on her sister's shoulder and expire at the exact moment she's getting her freedom? Did doctors even speculate on psychological factors?
They did, though they could never prove it. The prevailing theory, when you consider their extreme psychological profile and the pact, was a theory of psychological suppression.
Meaning?
Given the intense level of control they exerted over involuntary actions like breathing and blinking, some experts wondered if Jennifer, fulfilling her side of the pact, somehow willed her own body to shut down.
How is that even possible?
Perhaps through acute suppression of breathing or inducing a fatal cardiac arrhythmia via an extreme vagal response. But again, the physical evidence for this is elusive.
which forces us to take what June believed very seriously. What did she say about Jennifer's final moments?
June later stated that Jennifer's heart stopped because she chose it. She believed it was a voluntary, intentional act of sacrifice.
And that's the heart of the Givens mystery, that Jennifer was the one who engineered the solution to their shared conflict.
If they truly shared one psychological life, then Jennifer committed a calculated, targeted internal execution for the benefit of the surviving half.
And the immediate transformation in June is the most compelling piece of evidence that this was a necessary severing, not just a random tragedy.
Oh, it's absolutely stunning. The moment Jennifer died, the silent June just vanished. She began speaking normally.
Fluently.
Fluently. Conversing with doctors, engaging with the staff at the new clinic. The entire psychological barrier that had defined her existence for 2 decades just dissolved with Jennifer's last breath.
She began, quote, living a normal life as if she had been waiting her entire existence for that moment.
It implies that June, the individual, was held captive by this two-headed June and Jennifer entity. And only the physical elimination of one half could unlock the other's voice and autonomy.
It's proof that the psychological prison they built together required a physical execution to be dismantled.
Yes. June was freed from the destructive interdependence. She went on to live quietly, to write again, to function in society. Her ability to operate was literally purchased by Jennifer's life force. It's almost as if June's natural development was entirely suppressed for 20 plus years, just waiting for the necessary condition, Jennifer's absence, to be met.
That's one way to look at it. Another is that Jennifer's personality, the one articulated so destructively in the diaries, was the anchor to their pathological state. And when she removed herself, the remaining component, June, was healthy enough to integrate.
So Jennifer's death was the ultimate self-prescribed therapeutic intervention.
It seems so. So if we synthesize all of this, the secret language, the aggressive physiological mirroring, the synchronized crime, the chilling pact, and this sudden terminal death right at the moment of liberty, what are we left with?
The undeniable fact that the core mechanism of their existence was resolved on their own terms.
No one truly knows what biological or psychological trigger Jennifer pulled. The death remains unexplained by conventional science or medicine. It transcended simple psychology. They weren't just twins.
They were something else.
A closed, fatal system that operated under rules known only to them. And those rules demanded an absolute sacrifice for the freedom of the survivor.
The ultimate control they sought wasn't over their individual lives, but over the destiny of their shared unit.
And the only way to resolve that internal violent fight was through finality. The sources repeatedly emphasized this fatal interdependence. It wasn't a connection they could moderate or manage.
Wow.
It was an all-consuming system that necessitated a binary choice: shared imprisonment or singular freedom purchased by death. And the sheer efficiency of the outcome, June achieving normalcy, instantly validates how severe the pre-existing condition truly was.
And Jennifer made that purchase with absolute finality.
She did. And June, the survivor, has always maintained that Jennifer gave her a gift. It's a tragic, unsettling story about the price of autonomy when two souls are locked so inextricably together. #conclusion.
This deep dive into the case of June and Jennifer Givens, it truly challenges every conventional understanding we have of self, of identity, relational psychology, even mortality.
It really does.
Let's just quickly revisit the staggering timeline that defined their shared life.
We tracked the silent childhood in 1970s Wales, defined by that secret language that forged an isolated world, a world fueled by simultaneous love and hatred documented in their diaries.
Then that pathological connection evolved into a psychological war, the fighting for control over one life, which we saw in the bizarre, voluntary physical mirroring of breath and blink.
That terrifying internal conflict then spilled out into synchronized crime, arson, theft, vandalism, which led to their institutionalization in Broadmoor. And finally, the ultimate pact declared by Jennifer.
One of us has to die so the other can live.
The story climaxed with the sudden, medically unexplained death of Jennifer in 1993, right as they were being released. And this was immediately followed by June's profound and complete transformation into a functional, speaking individual. It's an unnerving and unique record of fatal interdependence.
The core takeaway here for me is that some connections just transcend standard biological or psychological labels. Some twins aren't just connected. They're bound by something deeper than science or standard pathology can fully explain.
Their bond acted as its own governing and ultimately its own lethal system.
And this story forces you, the listener, to confront how fluid identity itself can be. We assume identity is singular, housed within one body.
But the Givens case is this stark, tragic example of how a profound, mutually enforced interdependence can become its own structure, a structure that often requires a radical, life-ending action to be undone.
It makes you wonder not just about free will, but about agency within a symbiotic relationship. If June gained her ability to function and speak only through the death of her twin, does that imply the pre-existing state was a single, shared entity that required a surgical severing, a necessary biological correction for the sake of the unit's survival?
That is the essential and profound question that just lingers. If Jennifer sacrificed herself, was it an act of free will, choosing the fate of the entity, or was she simply fulfilling the final, necessary function of their shared psychological system?
Which twin truly possessed control in the end? The one who chose death or the one who gained life?
A mystery locked within the silence they kept for so long and the death she carried out.
Indeed. It forces us to ask if the greatest act of love between them was the greatest act of self-annihilation.
A heavy thought.
A very heavy thought. And look, if you want a full breakdown of the case notes, the timeline, some of the specific diary excerpts, and the source material we've referenced, you can find all of that. We've put it together for you.
Just follow at Inspector Story.
We really encourage you to explore the concept of extreme twin psychology further. The silent twins show us that sometimes the boundary between two people is the most powerful and arguably the most dangerous place of all.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive.
We'll see you next time.